Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode. And today I'm joined by Kerry Christie. And Kerry is in Perth in Australia, but she's originally from the UK. Welcome.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Now, would you like to just give a little bit of background? Because Kerry's case is a little bit of an unusual one. But it very much highlights the not just the flaws in the UK, but the flaws in that currently exist in throughout Australia as well, where domestic abuse occurs and family matters overlap. So, do you want to just give a little bit of background?
Yeah. So we moved here in 2014 as a family, I discovered that year that he was addicted to pornography, and that was like the demise of our relationship. So I've been suffering from the effects of domestic abuse, obviously, the whole time we were married. Didn't realize I was suffering domestic abuse until I started leaving that relationship. And then the abuse actually got worse, I would say, once I left. So for the last 7-8 years, even though we've been separated, I have still suffered the effects of domestic abuse.
So when you say that you didn't realise, what knowing what you know now, what were the red flags that you were normalising prior to
dishonesty? So like from the very start of the relationship, dishonesty, but to begin with, blaming other people for the dishonesty, and then over time it becomes my fault that he's being dishonest. The rage when you criticize them, or not even criticize them, just like point something out that could be done better, or you disagree with something that they want to do, the rage that ensues, and you're bombarded by, you know, but why? And then their explanation as to why you should do it, and they wear you down. So the rage and the dishonesty, the control, like he used to come out with me to my job. And obviously when you're in the throes of first love, you're like, oh, isn't it nice? He's coming out with me. You know, love spending time with me. Now I look back, I'm like, no, he was doing it because he wanted to keep an eye on me, actually.
Yeah.
Didn't see any of that. And even when we would get into physical fights, I didn't even think that that was not normal. So there was lots and lots of red flags that I missed at the very start of the relationship and throughout the relationship. Definitely the control, the financial control, the dishonesty. Yeah.
And these are the subtle things that people tend to miss, because these are normalized in society. They're normalized. They're not, you know, certainly in schools, you know, they are minimized, you know, when children do it, and the more longer they go on, they become. A reasonable behavior for the perpetrating party to engage in, and actually you pushing back, well, that's seen as you being unreasonable, whereas actually it's not. And that's that. This is why I always professionals need to look at the bigger picture. They have to look at the whole jigsaw puzzle as a whole. You know, that in on its own doesn't seem like, okay, this could lead to a loss of life, as an example. or lead to what you ultimately ended up experiencing. That on its own, you're like, well, no, we can't say beyond reasonable doubt that that's going to happen. Of course we can't. And that's why we need to look at the pattern of behavior, because the more serious behaviors don't just come out of nowhere. It is a slow introduction, and it creeps up on you. It isn't something that come just you wake up one day and then suddenly you've got all these extreme behaviors. It doesn't happen that way.
No, I like the analogy of the frog, that if you put a frog into boiling water, it would jump straight out. But if you put the frog into cold water and you turn the heat up on that water, it boils to death. That is exactly how this happens. It's all very subtle in the beginning, and then it gets worse and worse and worse. Even the sexual control, when I look back now, it all makes sense. I had absolutely no idea that he was addicted to pornography, like none. And I kind of feel a bit daft now because I'm like, there are signs, Kerry. But the pressure, the moods that they go in, if you don't comply, if you don't want to, and it's very.
Because you end up complying, it looks like you are complying, but you're comply you learn to learn that actually, if I don't just go along with it, that actually it's going to lead to X, Y, and Z behaviors. Well, actually, so it's easier just to and safer to just go along. Well, compliance under the veil of fear is coercion, and
About
that's
stonewalling, the walk, everyone explains it like walking on eggshells, and that's exactly how it is, because their moods are always very up and very down, and you never know what mood they're going to be in. And God forbid you refuse to have sex with them or agree with something they want to do, you get stonewalled, they don't speak to you, they're in a mood with you. So, but you just think that's part of being in a relationship with someone who's got mood swing problems.
Because that it happens more often than not in relationships, and that's why it's become so normalized. So it's only until you are so deep into the relationship and that you've added layers of commitment. And again, this is why we always have to consider what's happened at each milestone of the relationship, so that we can understand where how things have escalated, because they do just slowly escalate.
The more you go, I found the more I went for therapy, the more it escalated, because now I was aware and now I was watching his behavior and going, hang on, this isn't right. And so it actually gets worse sometimes when you go to therapy.
Because they know that they've lost a layer of control over you. That's why,
And even, that when you're a certain type of person as well, like when I found, because he denied, my daughter watched him one night. She caught him watching pornography, and I went to check on her, like, why are you upset? And she wouldn't tell me. And when she finally told me, I went to confront him, and he denied it. And I said, yeah, but she just sat watching you. No, I was on a work website. No. And then you're like, well, hang on, why would my daughter say that? But why would my husband lie? So then you go looking for the evidence, but you feel bad for looking for the evidence because you feel like you're in the wrong for snooping. But you like going, I'm going crazy here. Like, who's lying to me? And eventually, when I found it on a bank statement and I found the payment portal that linked to a pornography website, then of course, once you've got the evidence, but then you're the crazy one because you've now gone looking for the evidence.
You're not just the crazy one, you're the de deceitful one.
You're like, well, if you'd have just told me. But and then it turned out, yeah, he had to admit that, yeah, and we had to go for therapy, to deal with his sex addiction and porn addiction, and it was quite a severe one. But through that therapy, the relationship got worse. So for 3 years I stayed, even after he attacked me in the street one day. I tried to confront him about because he wasn't meant to be on any form of social media back then. Social media wasn't as heavily used as it is now, and I'd confronted him in a cafe, which stupidly I should not have done out in public because I don't like public displays of conflict. But I felt safe. I think that's why I did it. I think in a cafe in a public area, I felt safe bringing it up. But of course, he was starting to get loud, and I was like, nope. I'm not doing this. So I walked out of the cafe and he followed me. He jumped in his car, followed me, shouting at me to get in the car. I turned up a side street. He followed. The next minute, he was behind me, grabbed the back of my hair, dragged me backwards a few meters, and then lifted me up off my feet. So, which I screamed, and people came out of their houses. They called the police. And luckily, a man had turned around and followed us. He'd seen my ex pursuing me. So this guy had turned around and he took me to safety. And I just think, isn't it crazy that that day I felt safer getting into a car with a strange man than I did my own husband? Makes no sense, you know?
And the thing with therapy, whose idea was the therapy?
Me.
And this is the reason I asked you that was because, and I knew you that was going to be your answer. Therapy, people can be caught off guard when therapy is engaged in. They can see as a view it as, well, there's a willingness to change, there's a willingness to fix. So therefore it reduces the level of intent behind their behaviors. But what they do is, and it can even happen when they suggest it as well, but more so, particularly if it's the other person that suggested, they are doing it to lead you into a false sense of security. They are dangling you the carrot of hope of potential change. They're doing it to gain back control of a dynamic that their control's slipping. And this is what professionals really need to understand, because I've seen it so many times where professionals think that because the other party has engaged in therapy with the we, as a couple or even independently, that they are there's a willingness to change, that they re somehow reduces the intent behind their extreme behaviors. And you've got to bear in mind that they are potentially doing it to gain back control, not because they have a genuine willingness to change. It's the same with the perpetrator programs. They will willing, of course, they will engage with the in the perpetrator programs because what's the alternative? The alternative is that they face serious consequences. So they are engaging in the lesser of the two evils to gain back control of the narrative of the environment that they are currently navigating. And that's
You come up against some terrible therapists too. That's the other thing people need
because they
to.
don't understand that neither, Kerry. That's the problem.
They don't understand. And obviously, you don't understand because you've only just started realizing what's going on in the relationship. So you're just trying to find a counselor, a therapist. And then you get in front of these therapists that don't really understand domestic abuse and
Or the
what your feelings are.
psychology of victims and perpetrators.
I mean, we sat in front of a counselor and she asked my ex-husband a question and he lied. He said something that was dishonest and she caught him. So she pressed him on the matter. And of course, he didn't like that. So he started getting very agitated, very angry. And then she said, okay, now that's the hour. So we have to leave it there for this week. And of course, we left that appointment and he was raging. Raging in the car to the point that I jumped out of the moving car.
So she's poked the bear, not tried to smooth the waters, and left you with the raging beast leaving that appointment, and his fury has to be directed somewhere. And I always say that even with, even with in with employers as well. You know, if they have internal conflicts and issues with the perpetrator of their own, how they handle those conflicts is important, because if they are displaying behaviors that are dangerous and damaging towards other people within that setting, you rest assured there will be far worse behind closed doors where nobody can see them. So if you don't handle your own internal conflicts with that person carefully, the person behind closed doors will pay the price for it. And that's something I can speak firsthand on, because I experienced that firsthand. You know, my ex's employer had serious, you know, conflicts with him, and because they mishandled those, they seriously mishandled those, I bear the brunt of it. So professionals have to be really careful how they, because, and that's why we always say that in the minute police, as an example, are involved, and family court are involved, risk increases tenfold. You have to be careful. You always have to be. It's a real fine line. You've got to be navigating. You're navigating the right decision for the children, certainly in the family court setting. You're navigating the right decision for the children, but by implementing, this is why we need family and criminal to work in synergy, and they're not. Because if the family court do what is right by the children, and the perpetrator doesn't get their own way, it doesn't remove the risk. All it does is it manages one area of the risk. It manages it a bit better for the children. But if the perpetrator can find you, as in that example with that rugby player that obviously was the result of Queensland getting coerced control in, if he can find you, you're at risk of last resort thinking. So, you know, the risk just moves, you know, takes another form. And that's why we need criminal and family to work in synergy. And if they're not doing that, risk is not being managed effectively. Because what one professional does can indirectly increase risk. It might manage it in one area, but it can increase it in another area. So we always need to be on the ball and thinking all of the time, because that's why we need things like, you know, I mean, I know you've got it is in Australia, but the GPS tagging, but I don't think they use it as effectively as what the likes of Spain are.
We need
Yeah,
for some things.
GPS tagging should be mandatory. I think when they restrict access to the children via the family court system, and they identify that there is a high risk indicators, I think that should all also it should also bring in the GPS tag in, because it might not be enough to meet the criminal threshold, but the risk is still present. It's just taken another form. So we need to monitor that person to make sure to really ring fence the safety of the child, of the children, and the adult victim.
I do think there needs to be tougher. Like over here, it's three. So if you breach your FVRO 3 times, you go straight to prison. But you've got 3 chances.
That's
You
a
know, I was told by the police to stay safe. Stay safe, Kerry. When you come out of your house, make sure you're aware. You know, be careful. Thanks.
So it's back on your shoulders.
On me.
Not if they
Terrible.
breached, right round. Now you've proved you can't follow instructions, you can't follow rules. Now we're going to hold you accountable. Now we'll give you another chance. It's the same, you know, things like if they don't turn up to court, they'll give them another chance in family court. Yeah, why would you keep giving somebody chances?
They do. They
That they've
do.
already
They
shown
do.
disrespect to your process and your system, and you know your time. You keep giving them chance after chance after chance after chance.
And we need them to bring in, like, there has to be sets of like rules and things that they follow, because and the training, because over here the police are not, they're on the front line, and
Yeah.
yet they're not being trained in
No.
domestic
They're
violence.
not.
Like, I had to go to a police station with a conduct order, and the police told me that it was not the same as an FVRO, Family Violence Restraining Order, and I had to sit there arguing my case, and I
Yeah.
gave up in the end, and I went to another police station, and the police officer said the same. No, Kerry, in the morning, go straight to the court, get an, I said, I don't need to go to a court. This is a conduct order, but it's an FVRO. They've just called it something different. No. So I went home, and the domestic violence unit from the police station called me the next day, and they said, Kerry, you're right. It is an FVRO. So we're now going to call the police station and get them to go and arrest because it is a breach. Why am
People are
I
gas,
having to tell the
yeah.
police what's going on in the courts?
Exactly. I mean, people are gaslit into silence. And unless you are, I mean, even me, and I'm trained to a high standard. Even me, are they? I know they're gaslighting me. Then they put you because they are the authority figure. Your nervous system feels like I can't challenge you. I know you're talking absolute nonsense. You have no idea what you're talking about. You have no idea what you're doing. But there's an element within you that feels like, well, I can't challenge you. There's only so much I can challenge you, and that's even me. I find sometimes I have to like regroup with myself. I'm like, right, no, okay, now we've need to, and I find it easier challenging them via email than I do verbally, because it's easier to gaslight me, because my nervous system still remembers when I wasn't the expert that I am today, of being gaslit and feeling like, well, what you're saying doesn't feel right, but I haven't got the knowledge, or I'm not, I had to challenge you.
Well, I
So
went to a police station one day when he'd breached the VRO. He'd walked within 20 meters of my place of work. He knew I'd been there ever since we'd been to Australia. He knew exactly where I was that morning, and he walked past twice. When I went to the police station, the young officer said, "Oh, but did he look at you when he walked past?" And I said, "What do you mean, did he look at me?" And he said, "Well, did he look at you?" And I said, "No." He said, "Oh, well, I don't think it's a breach then." And I said, "Hang on a minute. It does not say on this order that he has to look at me." Well, see, if I'd have been there maybe a year or so before, I would have gone, "Oh, okay." But because now I was experienced in it, I said, "No, that's not true." And he said, "Yeah, but the women that were in the class with you, are they your friends and your clients?" And I said, "Yeah." And he went, "Oh, don't think that's going to stand up in court then, Kerry, because your witnesses are your friends and your clients." And I was like, "Can you just go and check with your sergeant? Because I don't think that's right." And he went and checked, and he came back and apologized and said, "No, you're right, Kerry." I was like, "I know." So then they went and arrested again. So it's just the training's terrible.
It is terrible. It doesn't matter where you are, the training's terrible. Well, we're just going to break for a short interval, and we shall see you in a minute.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise, elevate your earning potential, Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So we're just going to cover your, do you want to go into your, when you're doing this with family course, because yours were, wasn't great. Let's just say it how it is. It wasn't great.
No, it wasn't great from the start. You know, he was ordered to pay spousal maintenance because I wasn't working at the time, and he didn't pay it. And I was in front of the magistrate one day and I said to her, hey, he isn't paying his spousal maintenance. And she just went, I haven't got time for that today. Go and put a form in. And you're just like, you were the magistrate that ordered that. And I'm stood in front of you now, but now I've got to go away. And as a woman from domestic abuse, being financially abused, that means I've got to go away, find the form, fill it in, submit it. I've got to spend another day to come to court. I've got to pay for parking and fuel that I can't afford, when you could just deal with this now. And it was just, it was constant. I mean, there was a couple of times I represented myself, and I...
Was yours dealt with magistrates, not a judge?
Magistrates.
So that's another, that's another layer of, and this again, it's something, it's the same here in the UK. I do not agree with magistrates dealing with any cases in regards to domestic abuse at all. They are not trained. They're not trained professionals. They're not trained in law. They're not trained in any clinical backgrounds. They are no different to a jury in my eyes. And I don't think it's right. They are given surface level training. They have a legal advisor there for that very reason, because they're not trained, you know, legal professionals. And yeah, okay, you could get a magistrate that, you know, is good. But again, it's like you could get a jury that is good and sees, yeah, you know, the obvious. But if bias is much easier, we can get bias with professionals as well. But
it's hit and miss.
It is. But it there's more chance of bias coming in when you're dealing with somebody who's not trained in this.
Yeah. I mean, and you even look at the things that go on. So like he would say he'd got no money, claimed, you know, suddenly his business had, you know, gone down and he'd got no money. And yet he would turn up to court with a barrister. And you're like, yeah, are you not seeing this? He's telling you he has no money to pay his spousal maintenance, his child support, but he's bringing in a barrister, you know, and then because he's got a lawyer, but he's working. I have to get lawyer, because I was new to this at the beginning, as we all are. There's no way you can represent yourself at the start of this journey, and then you have a lawyer, but you can't afford to pay a lawyer.
Yeah,
you can apply for legal aid, but in Australia they will only give you legal aid for children's matters, not for financial matters. So they will drag you through the court system because they can, because they're getting money from their place of work, from their job, and you as a woman that was a stay-at-home mom has no money, but you're having to have this lawyer. And so the pressure that puts on you as well.
Yeah, it does. It does. And legal aid is, in my opinion, it might be free, but it's not free if it ends up costing you the safety of yourself or your children. Because generally speaking, legal aid is given to legal aid. The only people that will take legal aid jobs are the more inexperienced. legal professionals, and even then, they are either inexperienced and wanting to prove themselves, but still you can't remove the fact that they are inexperienced. Or they are cutting corners. So the bigger their caseload on legal aid, the more chances they are of cutting corners. Neither's good
100%.
for it. Neither's good for a high risk family court case.
No, and I saw that really. They don't give you as much time and attention because
No, they
they
don't.
are obviously charging a lot less. I was even with a lawyer one day, and we had to get the affidavit in by, say, 4 o'clock. And I went to her office, and instead of sitting in the office with her, they put me in a separate room, and her secretary was running between us, and I remember thinking, why don't you come sit in the room with me? And then she was doing it at the 11th hour, and it was all just rushed through. It wasn't correct. So you do get that with legal aid as well. They don't give you the same attention because they're not getting paid. They're getting paid, $500 an hour by someone else, maybe 100 for you. They're not going to give you the same time and attention.
No. And this is where I always say that people are better off self-representing, but the problem is they need to be best, but very well prepared. They need to be clued upon and include up how to present their case and the risks around their case. And they need to be on a from a regu from a nervous system regulation perspective in a stable position to do that. And therefore, they need support in building their case, and they need support in regulating their nervous system, which those are the two things that aren't being provided to victims of domestic abuse.
No, not at all. And even when it's recognised, I had all the evidence. We had breaches of VRO. I had text message emails. We did have a judge in the end for children's matters. They took my oldest son overnight while I was asleep. So my ex and his family arranged a flight for my oldest son. So I woke up in the morning, he was gone. And then with the youngest one, they took me to court. So we did have a judge, but he was not in a great mood when he walked in court that day at all. He was shouting at my lawyer. He was being quite nice to my ex's lawyer, even though my ex was in prison. His mom came via satellite link into the court. And I had all evidence, text messages, emails. We even had recordings of prison phone calls of my ex plotting and planning all of this and what he was going to do. His idea was to get me kicked out of the country first, but that didn't work. So then it was get the kids, get my boys over to the UK. He would get transferred from prison, which he did. So we had prison phone calls and him saying the most awful things to my boys about me. They were saying things like, go and take all your mum's Zumba money, that will F her up. Go and take her car keys, eat all of her food. Your mum's crazy, isn't she? Like, really terrible, damaging things. And the judge's comment was, how long is it going to take me to listen to these prison phone calls? Because I've got a busy diary. And you're just sitting there going, you're about to try and remove my child. And you're saying, what? And so the two lawyers had to get together and reduce the phone calls down to like a couple of calls. The judge listened to them and said that no, there was no evidence of abuse, and they allowed the flight ban to be lifted off my youngest son, who was 14 at the time. So that was at 10 a.m. By 10 p.m., they had my son on a flight to the UK on his own, no chaperone.
And how old was he?
14. They wouldn't even let me take him to the airport. They dug the boot in a little bit further and wouldn't let me drive him to the airport. So I had to drive separately. Even though I'd spent all day with him, we went for one last game of golf. We had coffee, laughing, joking, absolutely no issues. Put him on the plane, got to Dubai, told me he was safe. He was at the gate. I was like, good, okay, great. As soon as he got to the UK, they cut contact.
Wow.
So, yeah, but yeah, they did. My lawyer did get an appeal together. He said, Kerry, we're going to appeal this. This isn't right. The appeal goes to the judge that made the decision.
Well, that's not supposed to be the way.
Yeah.
Appeal's
Imagine
supposed to
that.
go to a different judge.
No, it goes first to the judge that made the decision. And I was, by that point, I was exhausted mentally, emotionally. So the appeal was to put it in order to get him back.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's the point? Like, they've turned him against me so much. Like the day my ex got arrested for the breach of the VRO, he went home and told my son that I got him arrested. And that was it. That ruined our relationship. My son never hugged me again after that moment. So it was just like, well, my son thinks he wants to live over there. So let's let him do that. Let him see how it really is. If he comes back, he's just going to be more angry with me
Yeah.
for getting back. So I just need now to heal from this, and hopefully one day they'll see the reality. My oldest son did a year and a half later. He came back, he bought his own plane ticket, sorted his own visa, and he came back to visit me. So, hectic.
Yeah, it's not good. We're just going to break for another interval, and we shall we'll continue this conversation when we get back.
The station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
The station that makes you feel good.
So, welcome back. So, how has it affected you, Kerry? Because I know this has—it's really taken its toll on you, haven't it? And I know she comes across as very upbeat, very—you know—you would think you would think that she was coping well, and she is, but. It's very different. The reality is very different, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Like, there's definitely been times where I didn't want to go on. Like, I've had those times where I've sat in front of a tree, yeah, there's been a few times. There's like one day I was driving home, literally writing the letters to my children in my head because I was like, I don't want this. And it wasn't that I didn't want to live because I love life. I love life. I just didn't want to be without my children. I didn't want the pressure anymore that was being put on me. His family were contacting my places of work, trying to get me kicked out of my jobs. At one point they were ringing the police. They were ringing, DCP here, Department of Children and Protection. It was just a lot. And then I was facing visa issues because as an immigrant here, once you leave your husband, you also leave your visa. So he was affecting my visa status as well. So I lost that. I lost my working rights through fighting through that. So yeah, there was times where it's just like, what's the point? What is the point in living anymore? But luckily for me, the one thing I recommend to a lot of people is get community around you. It's definitely having those friends. Like the day I was writing the letters, as I pulled up on the drive, a friend was ringing. And I remember looking at the phone and going, you've got to answer it. You've got to answer it, Kerry. So I answered it and I told her my thoughts. And she said, stay on the phone. We're on our way. And so she kept talking to me the whole way. And then they got there and we chatted. And so I would say community has been huge for me, having those friends just to sit and talk to, coffee, ring. And then exercise was huge for me. Like in those moments where you just feel like everything's against you and you feel angry and, you know, depressed at the same time, just going to the gym and moving my body just for like an hour, just to forget, get out of the head, get into the body.
Yeah.
And then I've done things like all the stuff, the mindfulness, the meditation. One day I was in bed and I just thought, Kerry, you're the only one that can get yourself out of this. Nobody out there can support you, but no one can do it. What are you going to do? I was like, I'm going to meditate. I'm going to try some meditation. So I did. And that actually started changing things for me. Things started moving. So,
See, you know, this is a thing, you know, Kerry is in the holistic healing arena, you know, that is, you know, it's, we will, anybody who's trained in that sort of, in any therapeutic interventions would automatically default to these tools. But people who are not from that profession, and with that professional training background, don't have those tools. And this is what the system has to remember. You are adding to the inescapability. When we say about managing risk, and I talk about this a lot, managing risk is not just managing the risk of the perpetrator. You are managing risk of the impact of trauma. And unfortunately, that leads to, you know, Kerry's spoken about having those suicidal thoughts and not wanting to be here anymore. That is not unique. Just because Kerry's verbalizing it, it can happen. Those who don't verbalize it, even if they don't recognize them as suicidal thoughts, they will have thoughts of, I no longer want to be here. And it can take form in different ways. It can be visualizing having a car accident, for heaven's sake. That's how those thoughts can take form. It's not that they people don't relate those to suicidal thoughts, but they are thoughts of, I don't want to be here anymore. And it only takes one split second where something is acted upon. And it's too late to come back from. And there's many, many examples where that's happened, where somebody has acted upon something and unfortunately is too late. They regret it instantly, but the damage has been caused and they can't undo what they've done themselves. And this is what the system has to remember. You know, you have a duty of care to everybody. And victims of domestic abuse are incredibly vulnerable. Incredibly vulnerable. You know, you take a person's child away, you've taken their lifeline away. And, you know, it's all very well and good saying it's process, it's system policies, and that doesn't remove the reality that a life is being put at risk as a result of a decision that the system is making. You know, and, you know, I can see it in Kerry's face now. You know, she's kept it together, you know, until she started talking about that element of it. And that is what people do, even people who are trained in what we're trained in nervous system regulation support and therapeutic interventions. We can sound and come across and present strong, but the minute we start talking about the wound, the amygdala is reminded of it. and the nervous system will respond accordingly. So we're never really out the woods, particularly when your lifeline's at risk. The very thing that means the most to you is at risk. And they've also compromised your health, Kerry, as well, haven't they, with through these actions, which isn't great. You know, it's which adds another layer of inescapability. But, you know, the fact that you are still here fighting, I am incredibly proud of you.
Thanks. Yeah, I am.
and this is the thing, you know, if Kerry can still be here fighting, you know, and this is it, you just need that one seed of hope, and it's keeping yourself regulated enough just to live another day, live another day, live another day. You don't think too far into the future, because that's when you'll get you'll start to spiral. Get yourself regulated and just focus on one day at a time, and that's all you need to be doing until you gradually build yourself up. And you've got your work visa back up now, haven't you? And your rights to work. So, and that's the thing. You just, if she'd spiraled, she wouldn't be in the place that she's in today.
And that's why I'm doing, and like what you're doing, you know, thank goodness there's people out there, Kate, like you, that are raising awareness. And because sometimes when us women are in these situations, you feel so alone because nobody else is going through it in your circle.
Yeah.
So we need people to be talking about this so we can go, oh, so that's why I released my story. It wasn't to, you know, badmouth my ex or my children, or it's to help other women see that there are people out there going through this.
Yeah.
And I've got through it, and I've come through the other side. So I hope that we give women hope that they can also survive this and come out the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the big thing about this show is, I always, and obviously, you know, I talk about we cover some very, very, you know, some distressing topics with the guests that I have on, you know, but I always like to finish off with giving somebody that seed of hope, because we never know which story is going to resonate with one individual. And it can be that one story, that one situation that really clicks, and it's like that's what gives them, you know, puts the fire in their belly again, you know, and gives them something to cling on to. And that can be the difference between somebody sinking or swimming. And that's what I want professionals to start and understand. Your every decision you make decides on whether somebody sinks or swims. And by giving them that support, you can be the lifeline that they need to live another day.
I mean, when you look at that, they took my child from me, but where was the support?
No, there wasn't support.
Where was the people that came around me and said, hey, you just had your child. Like, we need to give you some therapy. Like, nothing. They just do it.
Yeah.
And you just left.
No.
To survive. You're in bed the next day going, I don't want to get up. I don't want to do this without my child. Like, they've taken my children.
Yeah. And they don't get it. They don't get it. They either don't get it, or they don't want to get it, or they don't care enough to, like, well, it's like taking an invaluable object away from you. You know, it's not just the trauma, it is the grief as well. You are grieving the life that you've been robbed of.
Yeah. I've had to grieve in the future. Mm-hmm. Like, I potentially will never, well, I've already missed out on so much, on their driving lessons, graduating from school.
Yeah.
You know, I have had to grieve thinking, oh, I'm going to spend Christmas with my children, my grandchildren. I potentially now don't get that. You know, they're in the UK, I'm in Australia. People say, why don't you go back to the UK? Well, because then I go back to fearing for my life.
Yeah.
So back to looking over my shoulder. I go back to, you know, I can't do that again. I've got myself into a really good place, and I can't go back to that.
No.
Because as we know, we're not safe as women from domestic abuse in any country.
No.
So I don't trust that I would be safe.
Over there. Well, thank you, Kerry, for joining me. It's been wonderful having you on. And what I might do is get you back on again. And with a friend of mine who's in Australia, she's a domestic abuse advocate and
Okay.
has a charity over there in Queensland. I know obviously you're Perth, but it'd be
Yeah.
good to get her on with you and have a chat about the complexities over there.
Yeah.
So I know we, obviously this is UK Health Radio, but we have listeners all over the world as well.
Yeah. I
So
think it's always interesting to see how each country is dealing with it as well. And
yeah.
is there similarities? What are we doing well? What are we not doing well? What are we
Yeah.
not doing well?
Yeah. Yeah. So that discussion with Lou would be great, actually. I'll arrange that with Lou.
Okay.
Well, thank you for listening, and we shall see you on the next episode.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls, and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There, you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specialising in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.